Welcome to Financial Perspectives, the podcast. Join the team at Foster Group and our expert guests as we explore a variety of subjects that could impact your financial life. We will cover timely economic and financial market news, a wide range of personal financial planning ideas, and investment topics. Ultimately, we want to encourage educated optimism and do our best to provide valuable insights to help you navigate your financial journey with confidence. Please stick around at the end for important disclosure information. More information about Foster Group can be found in our ADV brochure at fostergrp.com.
The One Big Beautiful Bill was signed into law by President Trump on July 4th. As much anticipated, a lot of feelings around that bill, good and bad. But one of the things we want to do is take a look inside of it and see how it might affect us, especially as it relates to taxes and estate planning. There were a lot of provisions in the bill. A number of them extended what was already in place in the Tax Cut and Jobs Act of 2017. So we'll review a little bit of that today. But to do that today, I'm joined by Ashley Verriger. Ashley is a senior lead advisor at Foster Group. She is also an attorney. She's been a trust officer, so she is really well equipped and versed on helping us to understand just how this new bill might affect our estate plans, what we may want to do as a result of that. We're also going to talk about just some things around estate planning in general, because this continues to be a topic of interest for clients of Foster Group. So Ashley, thank you for being here.
Yes, thank you for the warm welcome, Kent. It's great to be here, and we have a lot to talk about, clearly.
We have a lot to talk about as we've been going through this. Let's start here. You know, as the bill was going through things, there was some real questions as to what was going to survive, what was going to make it into the bill, what was going to come out. So what were some of the changes that we saw in the bills, particularly as it relates to estate planning, and then what things really didn't change or remained the same?
Yes, I would say this new piece of legislation enacted some incremental change for a lot of the estate planning that we're doing with clients. It doesn't represent a massive overhaul of the previously enacted law, but there are a few notable provisions to point out. So today, under the new law, each taxpayer or individual in a household can pass on a total of $15 million of wealth to any one of their choosing, heirs, children, grandchildren, friends, other family members, free of their estate owing any estate tax. And that amount is doubled for a married couple, so $30 million for two spouses. And that represents about $1 million increase from where we were today, which was $13.99 million per person. It couldn't be around 14. It had to have that decimal point in there. Or $27.98 million for a married couple. So it represents a little bit of an extension in terms of amount. What's notable about the change is that it's a permanent extension, and it will be indexed for inflation. So we can expect it each year to just creep up incrementally as it's done in the past several years. So it resolves a little bit of an uncertainty of where do we go from here if we don't have a new law. We were set to have a reversion back to previous levels, but that question is answered with this new piece of legislation.
Well, that's good. So when we think about the number of estates, let's say in the United States, that might be affected by the law or that might be taxable, it seems like that number is pretty small.
Yes, for as much hype and play as this concept gets in the media, the idea of the estate tax and the exemption amount, it only touches about 7,000 households per year.
Wow.
That few number of households would be in a position to need to file a return and would actually owe tax as a result of these levels. So a very small proportion of individual taxpayers and couples that this would actually impact. That doesn't mean we shouldn't still plan for it. There's plenty that we can do on the planning side, but it won't touch that many American households.
I think that's part of the conversation today. It can feel like there's a lot of things that maybe are very consequential in the bill as it relates to estate planning or taxes. I think what we'll find is, kind of like the estate planning, it's going to affect few people. But for those people who it does affect, obviously the planning is very important around that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think even if you aren't directly touched by this $15 million new exemption, there's still a lot of good reasons to plan that could be inspired by a new tax law.
Right. So what other changes? I know one area of interest for you is in charitable giving. What things changed there?
Absolutely. So a few new notable charitable deduction updates included in the bill. If you're using the standard deduction today, meaning you're not itemizing deductions, there's a new charitable deduction for standard filers, $1,000 for a single filer and $2,000 for a married filing jointly couple. So that means I can still deduct charitable contributions, even though I'm not itemizing, which is a benefit for many households. And then in terms of itemized filers, there's a new floor, which is an interesting development. Mm-hmm. So today, in order to be able to itemize a charitable deduction, there's a new floor, meaning 0.5 or 0.5% of taxable income. Your charitable gifts need to be in excess of that amount in order for your charitable gifts to be deductible on your Schedule A itemized deductions. So that represents a unique wrinkle and a little bit of a hurdle for itemized filers to overcome. And we'll see how that plays out as filing season starts.
Yeah, it's too bad. It just kind of adds one more schedule to the tax return that you think, why would we need to do that?
I mean, the paid preparers probably don't mind it. Gives them another thing to do on their return preparation for clients.
I guess that's probably true. So in addition to some of the estate tax changes, there are some other changes in the law. One of them is the SALT cap deduction of the state and local taxes.
Yes, that's new under this new piece of legislation. Currently, you are allowed to deduct $10,000 per year for your state and local income taxes, which also includes your property tax, your state income tax. And this was frustrating to a lot of taxpayers in high income tax states, because if you're paying a bundle in property tax and you can only deduct $10,000 of it, that's severely limiting what you're able to itemize on your return. With this new piece of legislation, that amount will be temporarily expanded to $40,000 per year, and that will last through 2028. And then in 2029 tax year, we'll go back to the current $10,000 per year level. So it represents a temporary piece of relief for those high income tax state filers who are most affected, but it doesn't represent a permanent change.
Yeah, and I think that kind of represents some of the complexity of the bill. In the past, there's been bills like this are passed and they have sunset provisions. And oftentimes the sunset provisions are there to make a congressional scoring work. They can only spend so much money without having associated revenues in order to pass the Senate. So I'm imagining that this is one of those things. But throughout the bill, there are some things that are actually going to have a limited life. But many things in the bill, thankfully, are permanent in the sense of until Congress chooses to change the law, these things will remain in place.
Yes, there's certainly plenty for advisors to sink their teeth into because, as you mentioned, some things are permanently extended and some have a deadline or an expiration date. So it's incumbent upon us to understand how that's going to apply for any of our client situations.
Yeah. So in moments like these, we kind of see about new tax legislation, people think, oh, well, maybe I need to do something. It's kind of one of those like, this is a transitional event. I need to revisit my estate plan. Would you say this represents something like that?
I would say for a lot of the families that I work with who tend to be business owners, executives, multi-generational families, many of those groups who might actually be impacted, one of those 7,000 households that could potentially owe estate tax, they have had some things that they're thinking about already in the works. And so for them, I would say it may be a continuation of that thinking. Mm-hmm. We have less of a deadline, but we still may owe estate tax in the long run. So it's always a good time to plan ahead for that. As we continue to learn more and have a little bit of a new legislative playing field to operate from. For those people who are not part of those 7,000 households, this bill can still be an excellent catalyst to dust off your plan, see what it says. Do I still like those provisions? Are there things that have changed in my life or in my circumstances that would motivate me to do something different? And if it takes a piece of legislation like this to motivate someone, I'm all for it. Because frankly, we all need to have an estate plan that can work for us. And it's very tempting to just do it once, let it go by, never pick it up for decades. And then potentially run into a situation that doesn't yield favorable results.
Yeah, I think the good news here is it's probably not urgent that somebody do something right away because so many of the things are going to remain the same. But similar to when we talk to people about thinking about their portfolio or putting it into place, maybe making changes, you know, it's best to make those decisions in times of relative calm. Our minds are a little clearer, we're not anxious about some change, we're not worried, maybe living in some kind of a fear situation, we're actually able to, I think a little bit more clearly.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I think there's a bundle of psychological research that would indicate when we are in times of stress, whether that's external or internal, we've had a stressful event happen, a loss in the family, a challenging financial situation, a significant health diagnosis. We're trying to navigate lots of things in our day-to-day life. And then we stack estate planning on top of it. We're really setting ourselves up to make some less than ideal decision-making because there's only so much information that we can process and work through at any given time. So I'm a firm believer of do estate planning when it's sunny. Don't wait for a rainstorm to befall you before you start doing this kind of work. Because if you're already overtaxed and burdened in terms of what you're mentally working through, you're not going to have as ideal of a result as you could if you were planning under less extreme conditions.
So you're saying if I were planning a international trip next year, let's say.
Yes, start now.
Start now.
Right.
I'm not signing when I'm on
the way to the airport, not the day before, not, oh, let's renew the passport and pay expedited processing fees to get it in a week. Hopefully the ink is long dry by the time that we're getting in the car.
So I think our point here is we're just encouraging you, starting the process, doing the planning far in advance can really be helpful and I think works well for people.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So if people are going to do a review, what are the documents that they should be paying attention to?
Yes, great question. Well, a fully fleshed out estate plan really has two or three primary documents that make it complete. And there's one that gets lots of attention, and then there's a couple that get a little bit less attention. So we'll shine a light on those. The big one, of course, is a last will and testament. And that's going to be the primary document that an individual will use to convey wealth from themselves to the heirs of their choosing, children, grandchildren, other family members, charitable organizations, friends. It's going to do things like pass on your financial property, your accounts, your real estate, farmland, and also just your personal belongings, all of the things that are inside of your house. A will is going to take those from your hands at passing into the hands of your chosen beneficiaries. And so that one's obvious. We need to have a document like that that can work for us. But the ones that get a little bit less airtime are two flavors of power of attorney documents. One for financial, which I think is the easiest to understand, and one for healthcare decisions. So let's start with the financial power of attorney. This document, what you're doing inside of this piece of estate planning work is you're naming an agent who can make financial decisions for you while you are alive, but for whatever reason, you aren't able to make those decisions for yourself. So maybe you've been in a car accident and someone needs to sign your tax returns, or maybe you have a brain injury or you're unfortunately dealing with Alzheimer's or memory loss, and you simply can't make those kinds of decisions for yourself anymore. You're still going to need help managing those things day to day. Your will can step in and help when you're no longer here. But for that vulnerable time when you need help, you're still alive, but for whatever reason, you cannot make those decisions on your own. That's where a financial power of attorney document is really going to come into life. And then in a similar vein, the healthcare power of attorney would do something very similar, but rather than for financial decisions, it would be for healthcare related decisions. Should I have the surgery? Should I receive the treatment? What if it's an exigent or urgent situation? You can understand the doctors are going to want to talk to someone who is empowered to make that decision, especially if time is of the essence. So very important, but a little bit less talked about probably than a will.
Both of those, I think, are super important. There's a third one that comes up in this context, the living will. And sometimes I think there's confusion as to the living will and the health care power of attorney. What's the difference?
Yes, I think it's easy to kind of conflate them. So the healthcare power of attorney document is really going to name that person, that agent of yours who is responsible for making those decisions. But the living will can be an opportunity for you to express your wishes on end-of-life care. So if you had faith-based considerations for artificial nutrition and hydration, a living will document could be a place to memorialize those intentions. Or if you wanted to be an organ and tissue donor, or if you had particular intent for your funeral, burial, or memorial service. Those kinds of things could be incorporated into a living will document. You can also address heroic measures in that kind of a document. So for some folks, if they're facing a terminal condition and then they happen to be in a car accident, do I take heroic measures to resuscitate me, or am I instructing the medical team to let me pass and keep me comfortable? Those are all the kinds of decisions that would be included in a living will type document.
Yeah. So each one of these, you're kind of saying, this is what I'd like to have happen. In each one of them, people need to nominate someone to actually help fulfill or to follow through. And in the conversation that we had, you used the word, you probably want to talk to the people you're nominating in advance,
right,
which I thought was great advice.
It is. It's one of the things I repeat to clients most often. We go through the process of estate planning, putting together a will, putting together a power of attorney document, putting together a trust. We have to name someone who's in charge of carrying those wishes out, because we either won't be here mentally to do so, or we just will have passed away and we won't physically be present to make sure that our intentions and wishes and instructions are carried out. So in all of those documents I mentioned, a will, a power of attorney, a trust, you're naming a person of significant responsibility and trustworthiness to make sure that your wishes are carried out. But when we name those people in the documents, it's a little bit of a myth in estate planning that when I've written down, well, I'd like my spouse to stand in the first position, and then I'd like my sibling to stand in the next position, and then, you know, maybe an adult child could be an appropriate choice next in line. When you're naming those people, it's not a conscription into service. You're not, they're not duty bound to step into that role for you. It's a nomination. It's an invitation to operate in that capacity. And so, like any good invitation, we want to actually extend it to the person that we're inviting, rather than just assuming that they're going to show up and say yes. So after the ink is dry on the documents, or even beforehand, let's talk to that person and say, I'm considering naming you in my power of attorney document in the event that I'm not able to make that decision for myself. Is that a role that you would be comfortable with? What questions might you have? Are there concerns or worries that you have in stepping into it? Let me assuage you. Let me talk. Let me talk to you about the other people in my life that could help you in that kind of a role. And we find that when you communicate ahead of time, you're much more likely to get a yes answer than a no answer, which often happens if the person hasn't been prepared or informed of that nomination. Because I don't know about it, and it's kind of a big responsibility, and I'm a little worried about going at it alone. You can understand why perfectly capable people might be motivated to say, no, no, thanks. That's not really right for me right now.
Yeah, I think especially if they've had a conversation with you in advance about your document, the idea there is they've had a chance to ask some questions. You've been able to actually talk to them. You know, they're not just reading it. They're actually hearing it from you as to, this is what I'd like, and this is what I'm hoping you'll be able to do. The other thing I know when we talk with folks about this, sometimes they're worried about, well, I just can't do all of that. Is there someplace I can go to get help? So talking about, yes, there are advisors that you already have in place. This is the attorney that I've worked with. These are the people who you can talk with who can help you to accomplish those things. That can be super helpful.
I agree. And I think there's a little bit of this perception that if I've been nominated in this role and I say yes, then I'm on an island and I'm doing it by myself and I'm totally up a creek without a paddle and there's nobody that can help me. But if you've had the conversation ahead of time, you can say, well, this is my advisor at Foster Group, and this is my accountant that I work with, and this is my attorney. And by the way, all of these people or their successors will be able to help you when it comes time for you to serve and help carry out my wishes. So you won't be going at it alone, and they've done it a million times. And so you don't have to be the expert in everything. You just have to have an understanding of what I would want.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. So we've talked a little bit about, now might be a good time to review these things. Obviously, circumstances change. People you may have named in previous documents, you know, I think about a younger person who might have named their parent, let's say, as their executor. Now they're older, their parent is maybe not in the best position to serve in that role. So it's time to review that and see what else might have changed. About how often, Ashley, do you think reviewing documents and making changes should happen?
Yes, I think there's one of these sort of myths around estate planning that once I've done the heavy lifting of putting my documents into place, whether it's for the first time or after many years and I'm doing a big overhaul, is that I just put it on the shelf when it's done and I wash my hands of it and I'm finished forever. And the reality is that actually the shelf life of a good estate plan isn't much longer than about 3 to 5 years, which is sort of daunting if you're a client to hear that. You may have to touch this thing every 3 to 5 years. You know how hard it was to touch it for the very first time. And now you're telling me I have to do it again and again and again. Like, I'm not prepared to receive that piece of advice. Very fair perspective. But what I will say is that 3 to 5 years is a good guideline, but life happens quickly. We've had folks who executed documents and not 6 months later they were back in their attorney's office because something changed. They got a medical diagnosis, they had a new birth in the family, they lost a loved one due to death or divorce. we can't predict at what clip or when those future significant events in our lives are going to unfold. So 3 to 5 years is a guideline, but don't wait 2 or 3 more years if you have a significant life event or milestone happening right now that would be a catalyst toward, well, 3 years ago I set this up and I liked it then, but now something major has changed in my life now and it doesn't produce a great result, but I'm still going to wait 2 more years because you said that 3 to 5 years was the guideline. No, no, no. Update it now as your wishes have changed.
Yeah. You know, both of you and I have watched people kind of work through that role where maybe they've had the death of a spouse or a child that has death of a parent. And one of the things that I have consistently seen is for those people who've done a good job of estate planning and communicating in advance, that is such a gift to the people who are coming behind you. They know what your wishes are. You've done a good job of putting things in order, so it's very easy for them to follow through. You know, it's a hard time for them to be following through because they're without you. So that experience of grief just makes it that much harder. And if you've done the work and made the investment of both the time, and yeah, it's gonna cost some money once in a while to do the documents, it's just a gift to those people as well as all the other things that you're going to do for them through your estate plan. So I think that's important to—
Oh, I couldn't agree more. I would say I'm a millennial, and as a generation, we are known for not really wanting to inherit things. Like grandma's china, I don't need to inherit that. But a well-designed estate plan that has been buttoned up ahead of time, I would love to inherit that. That would be a big comfort, especially if I'm dealing with something very stressful and full of grief, like the loss of a loved one. If I don't have to go through a Herculean effort to gather all the right documents and get all the people in the room and untangle some knots that I didn't really even know existed, the grief process by itself is hard enough to get through. And if you're adding those additional weights, it can be really hard for a lot of people to get through. So it's funny because in my practice as an advisor, some of the very most motivated clients to do estate planning are those who have had to do the hard way of settling a parent's or an ancestor's estate. They're saying, my parent didn't set me up the way that I would have preferred to have been set up. I'm never going to do that to my child. It was so stressful and difficult that it gives me anxiety to think about that being the situation for my kids or my grandkids. So let's do this now. I want to prevent that from happening. There's a set of people who feel very convicted about that. Yeah.
That leads me to think a little bit about kind of the non-official documents. So we've been talking about the very official documents. Some of them are kind of prescribed in their format. But I know in talking with you and others that there's some non-official, some informal documents or ways of communicating things to your heirs, to people who come after you, that can be really helpful.
Yes, I would agree with that very much. And I would say legal documents like a will, which is basically a set of instructions for your executor to follow, or a power of attorney document, which is a set of instructions, either medical or financial, for your agent to follow. They really aren't documents of family history or sentiment or feeling or a certain kind of emotional value sort of legacy. They're primarily a legal document that is a set of instructions. So a lot of folks think of their will or their estate planning documents as needing to encompass a lot of these more personal intentions or wishes or hopes or worries or stories. And I'm a big fan of passing those things down to your heirs to give context for the decisions that I've made in these legal kinds of documents, but they don't need to live in the will or the power of attorney. Let's write our loved ones a letter or do a video recording of ourselves speaking about this was my story and my background and my path to building the wealth that I did, and these were the formative lessons I learned and the mistakes I made and what my hopes are for my heir, and these are the foibles that I wish I didn't have to learn the hard way. I want you to have more information at an earlier point in your life. I always encourage clients to write that down in a letter. Do it in your own handwriting for maximum effect, because no one is going to tell your story the way that you will, the way that you can. No one is going to be able to convey that message, least of all a lawyer in a very dry last will and testament kind of document. So use your voice, and it actually produces superior results when it comes time for the children or the grandchildren to inherit the wealth. Because let's face it, when we have the legal side of the story, but not the emotional, relational side of the story, human minds, when they're presented with a suite of incomplete information, we're just going to invent the rest of that to make a full and complete story. So if you've handed your heirs a legal document, but with no contextualizing document for, well, these are the decisions I made, and this is why I made them, they may invent reasons that have no bearing to what your actual intents or wishes or thoughts or feelings were. So there's no substitute for you telling your heirs what your intentions are in your own words. It can really stop harmful stories from being told before they can even get out of the gate. Yeah. So I'm a big proponent of those personal messages.
Right. The harmful stories that can just be made up.
Oh, absolutely. We see it all the time. They're pure invention. They're like, mom didn't love me best, and that's why this document says this. And it's like, well, we could have avoided that with just a, dear daughter, dear son, I love you so much. These are my hopes for you. This is why I did this the way you did. Remember when I paid for that for you and I didn't for your brother? Now I'm making it fair. Oh, okay. Well, that's a little bit different than the you loved me less story.
Yeah. The nice thing about doing these things, too, are, you know, they don't require an attorney for you to write a letter. These are things that you can do on your time.
100%.
Really without cost, except for your time.
That's right.
We talked about recording things using your phone. There are certainly services now that will help you to do this if that's what you'd like, where you can make a very highly produced video. You can capture a lot of digital images or photographs and make sure, you know, this is exactly what you want. But don't let that be the reason to not do it.
Oh, absolutely.
It's so simple to write that letter.
Absolutely. There's no substitute from your own words, from the heart, whether you do it professionally or whether you do it informally.
Yeah, very good. Okay, so we've kind of covered a lot of things. maybe you're a little going, wow, that's a lot of stuff to cover. What I would encourage you is this, if this is kind of brought to mind, hey, I need to take a step here to maybe review this, we'd encourage you to contact your advisor to have that review and just get that conversation going. I know the foster group advisors have these conversations regularly, and they're super helpful. Even if there's no changes necessary, just reviewing it, having the conversation, making sure things are in order the way that you want, really can kind of relieve some stress, raise some anxiety that you might be feeling otherwise. Before we sign off, though, I want to give you the opportunity to have the last word. Is there anything that you're thinking about that you go, oh, I wish I'd said that, or here's something I think is important to take away?
Yes, I will leave you with this. There's this perception that what you write in an estate plan today has to be perfect, and it has to reflect what I want to happen for the rest of my life. But life doesn't work like that, and people don't think ahead like that. Future me in 5 years, I have no idea what that person may want. And so I owe it to myself to constantly check in on a regular basis or as life events unfold to take stock of, what do I have today? If it's something, do I still like it? Worst case scenario, I'm going to find some things that I might want to tweak. Great. I can have a conversation with my advisor about that. If I don't have anything, anything on paper is better than nothing. Because if you have nothing, then you're letting a law decide what happens to your wealth and your minor children and your legacy. So give yourself the benefit, give yourself the advantage of making that choice for yourself and owning it.
Great. Ashley, thanks for joining us today. This has been very helpful. You're obviously very knowledgeable, a lot for our listeners to think about.
Yes, plenty to sink your teeth into. Thanks for having me. It was a fun conversation. Start small.
Thanks for joining us. We look forward to seeing you next time.
The previous presentation by Foster Group was intended for general information purposes only. No portion of the presentation serves as the receipt of, or as a substitute for, personalized investment advice from Foster Group or any other investment professional of your choosing. Different types of investments involve varying degrees of risk, and it should not be assumed that future performance of any specific investment or investment strategy, or any non-investment related or planning services, discussion, or content, will be profitable, be suitable for your portfolio or individual situation, or prove successful. Foster Group is neither a law firm nor accounting firm, and no portion of its services should be construed as legal or accounting advice. No portion of the content should be construed by a client or prospective client as a guarantee that he or she will experience a certain level of results if Foster Group is engaged, or continues to be engaged, to provide investment advisory services. A copy of Foster Group's current written disclosure brochure discussing our advisory services and fees is available upon request or at www.fostergrp.com/disclosures.